Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Linda Antonsen is back to cover Sansa's second POV chapter. This is the Hands Tourney. Linda was excited to cover this particular chapter, and I was excited to have her. Linda, as you already know, is Martin's co-author. She co-authored World of Ice and Fire with he and Elio Garcia. Martin has said that she knows more about Westeros than he does, and she is one of the co-creators of Westeros.org. And on top of that, after more than 20 years of living in this space, she really still has a passion for the project, and was especially keen to cover the Hands Tourney. Steve and I cover Misa season finale for season 3. And Jana Matthews and I continue our conversation about guest right and hospitality. Without further ado, here is medievalist Jana Matthews. In many places in the ancient Near East, being dishonored was tantamount to being killed, yeah. Right? It was worse to be dishonored than to actually physically die, because the dishonoring would have an impact on your entire clan. And your progeny, and, you know, it would last longer than your own life.
Sure. I mean, there's also laws regarding hospitality and codes there too. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, Joffrey Baratheon's death is so, you know, is a violation of that code, which is when you're having a party, parties are often meant as peace building activities. And so you're kind of supposed to put your differences aside and join together. And, you know, that's a safe place. Everyone puts their weapons away. That this was an environment where people are not supposed to be killing each other. Again, like, there's ways in which that gets violated all the time, but in theory, it was supposed to be kind of a safe place.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Here's a question for you. Has George ever forgotten that a character is dead and doesn't know it and needs your advice? Like, is this character alive or dead?
Gosh, have you had anyone who has been dead? Of course, I blank too many names. Elio is the one who's like super on all the names. Well, but basically,
there's lots of names, that's for sure.
Yeah. There are a few changes between the appendices in the books where occasionally it's not clear what happened to a character, uh-huh. whether they died or not.
Now, if something like that, if there was a sort of a snafu in the appendix, is George the kind of guy who would think, okay, now I have to figure out how to write that into the story or drop a little hint later on that this is actually how that happened? Or would he shrug his shoulders and say, well, that's just the appendix?
Well, the first time, or one of the first times that we were in contact with him was about an appendix issue, in fact. It was after the publication of The Hedge Knight, where we realized that the ages of the Targaryen kings did not match up sure. with Baelor, Maekar, and their ages So he basically had to switch, make a brother and uncle instead.
I see. Yeah.
So he had to do an adjustment for the next appendices. Obviously, that was purely on historical characters. So that was not a problem. Uh-huh. There have been issues when we worked on The World of Ice and Fire where Elio pointed out a time discrepancy on a historical character, way back historical character. And George unfortunately said, "You're the only one who's going to catch that, Elio."
Nope.
Elio's not the only one who caught that. So sometimes George still lives in the bubble where he does not realize just how many very, very obsessive fans he has. He occasionally thinks that, well, there can't be more crazy people like Elio out there.
No, there are.
There are. But otherwise, he certainly tries to, when it is in the concurrent story, sort of the present story, that obviously takes priority. Mm-hmm. I mean, we submit when we catch things. We do submit to the editors. And if it's straightforward fixes, they fix them. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, it runs by George and he comes up with some solution mm-hmm. for...
Linda, do you get the sense that it really helps to have a good branding effort if you're a knight?
Yes, certainly. That is part, I think, of the whole chivalric culture as Martin displays it and how he writes about it.
If you want to be famous, I mean, it helps to have talent for sure, right? But if you want to be a famous knight, you have to have a really great nickname. Or you have to have a really dynamic branding effort.
I think generally they tend to go together. I mean, you get some nicknames or bynames are, you know, more basic. Like you've got Barristan the Bold, but that kind of sums it up pretty well. And it alliterates, so it's got that classic feel to it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, a lot of people... Or some fans will think, you know, Knight of Flowers. Well, that sounds kind of sissy. You get some people who have that attitude. But obviously, if you look at the way that Loras uses it with mm-hmm. in the tourney, with Sansa, like, you know, picking out the flowers from his cloak and everything, it's very much... something that he can use and that fits the Tyrell imagery mm-hmm. and it fits the chivalric imagery and all of that. And then, you know, you get the more sinister ones as well that clearly imply that you're quite badass. Like, mm-hmm. okay, how do you get the name the Red Viper? Well, you obviously didn't do something nice.
Well, yeah, Knight of Flowers certainly works on Sansa. She says that there's nothing more beautiful that she's ever seen in her life. And she has an eye for knights. I mean, she's observing them all pretty carefully.
Yeah, she's really learned the part of a lady at a tournament. You know, they don't get a lot of them up in Winterfell.
Right.
The Starks are more about melees and the, you know, more rustic and rougher parts of it. So this whole tourney experience is new to her in person, but she knows what it is about, and she has been taught what to watch for. Are they riding well? Are they behaving gallantly? Mm. She knows exactly. She is an expert watcher of the sport of jousting.
Poor Jory. Poor Jory has not figured out how to brand himself. He just looks like a pale comparison.
Yeah.
He's a shadow of a knight. I mean...
A limp cloak. Like,
now he...
That's not good for your brand.
Right. Now he has talent, right? He does well in the tournament. He does well, you know, representing the North. He does fairly well. However, he doesn't have someone behind him saying, okay, now what's your thing, right? Let's create a symbol for you. You know, let's get a better cloak for you, that kind of thing.
Yeah, he needs the guy that you have in Monty Python and the Holy Grail that's following behind and writing the story and, you know, really telling everyone how amazing you are.
Or the guy in Spinal Tap who's having to explain to him, like, this is what a good album cover looks like. And this is why maybe that one's not great. You know, he really needs a little help in that regard.
Yeah, he needs a manager.
He does. Jory needs a manager. All right. This chapter, man, this chapter is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I was reading it last night, and it was late, and I thought, you know what? I got to read this again. It's such a... Look, if you're listening to this podcast and you're not reading along with the book, at least read this one chapter. It's just magnificent. So here's my synopsis. Asanza, Septa Mordain, and Jane Poole ride to the Hand's Tourney. Sansa marvels at the magnificence of the event. Thousands have arrived to view the martial display, but few have a better view than Sansa. She loves it all, the gallantry, the drama, the armor, and especially the beautiful and talented Knight of Flowers. Jane is undone by a gruesome death caused by the point of Gregor's lance, but even that only fascinates Sansa. She briefly meets Peter Baelish, who cryptically recalls his affection for Kat. After the sun sets, she sits beside Joffrey at the feast. Joffrey and Sansa eat and laugh and flirt until the feast ends abruptly from Robert's drunken outburst. The Hound escorts Sansa home and mocks her courtesies. He scares her to tears when he forces her to look at his scars. Then, in the dark, Sandor Clegane recounts his childhood trauma, the story behind his ruined face. Sansa feels compassion for him as he sees her to her room. Before leaving, he tells her that if she reveals the secret of his burnt face to anyone, he will kill her. Linda Antonsen, would you like to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I just climb the ladder of chaos?
I think we can start a little thematically, and then it'll probably descend into chaos.
I love it.
Into chaos.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
So tell me about it. So thematically, so you're noticing a couple themes here?
I mean, my favorite part about this is that this is probably the chapter that most clearly illustrates how George plays with the two sides of the Middle Ages. Mm. You start off with the wonderful pageantry. You have all these wonderful colors, or the way that she says, you know, the curtain of the litter turns everything to gold. It's this fantasy world, and it is better than the songs. This is the Middle Ages of the chivalric legend. And that is what Sansa sees. That is what Sansa has been raised to see, this wonderfully idealistic picture of the Middle Ages. This is, you know, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, the height of everything good and chivalric. Mm. And by the end of the chapter, we are in this very dark place where Sandor recounts to her what a knight has done to him, somebody who is knighted afterwards anyway. His brother is not a knight at the time, but he becomes a knight and is able to commit such an atrocious act on his own brother, on a child. So you get this, you got on the one side the pageantry and the colorful technicolor Middle Ages, as I tend to call them. On the other end, you have this the hyper medieval part, which is all grim, dark, and dirty and brutal. I tend to go to the comparison with Monty Python's Holy Grail here, with, you know, when they're riding out in that muddy field, and you've got the anarcho-syndicalist peasants there who deny that Arthur is king just because he got the sword lobbed at him by a moistened bint or whatever. I love that whole exchange. But basically he says, you know, he identifies him as the king because he hasn't got any shit on him.
Now,
that's the hyper-medieval, the really dirty side. And a lot in A Song of Ice and Fire is George playing with those two images and the contrast. And when people like Sansa's story in particular, it's about realizing that life is not a song.
Now, I think Now, try this on for size. You can tell me what you think about this. I think that unless you have these little moments where you can kind of see this, you know, let's say we see King's Landing through yellow silk, right? So we see this idealized King's Landing. Unless we have those little moments, the cruelty doesn't work nearly as well. Like the darkness of the way this chapter ends is all the more dark because we've seen how beautiful it can be through Sansa's eyes.
Absolutely. I think that really is one of the major themes that George works with in terms of sort of loss. I mean, loss overall.
Right.
So loss of beauty, loss of innocence. Ruins is something that has figured in his work, not just in Song of Ice and Fire, but particularly in other novels and short stories. Ruins that are left behind we see it in later on in Song of Ice and Fire, where they visit the city when they're traveling on the Rhoyne and go through Croyane, the Rhoynish city ruined and all wrapped in mist, and the sadness of the loss of beauty and that cannot be recaptured is absolutely always present. And for that to work, you have to experience it, or you have to see that there are some people who see this beauty and then it's taken away from them. It makes it much more poignant. It makes it hit much harder than if you just open up. You can do that. I mean, I don't know, have you read Mary Gentle's Ash?
Yes.
A Secret History.
Yes.
Where the first, I think it's the first line, is it was her scars that made her beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, you're starting off very dark with this,
you know what,
mercenary girl. So you can do it, but it's a very different experience.
This chapter reminds me a little bit of Bran's second POV chapter, in that the entire chapter is exploring really Bran's love for climbing. So he's a very able-bodied person. But through that, you're also learning about all of the nooks and intricacies of Winterfell, right? Because he's climbing all over Winterfell. And it's so important to him. It's so important to him that he can go, you know, climb higher than anyone else and commune with the birds. And it's just core to his identity that he's an able-bodied person. And so when he falls and then we find out what's been taken away from him, it's a real moment of grief. And this, and something very similar is happening to Sansa in this chapter. I think really core to her identity is this mythology of the Seven Realms and the mythology of the gallant and honorable knight, or the true knight.
Yeah.
Core. This is just,
no, it shakes her so much.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so when that is taken away from her, I mean, it's taken away tiny bits and pieces here and there. She's realizing
chipping away at it. Obviously, she's already lost her wolf.
That's right.
But there, she's trying to, as we see in this chapter, she tries to put it on. Oh, it was Arya's and Cersei's fault. It's not my Joffrey.
That's right.
She still has her faith in him, and because something beautiful can't be evil.
She needs to tell herself that story over and over and over again. Yes. She knows that Joffrey's a monster, but has convinced herself that he's not. She knows that the Knight of Flowers is just the picture of beauty. And, you know, these are the stories she keeps telling herself over and over and over again. And then when she has that moment in the dark with Sandor.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know if she's going to be able to recover from that vivid image of what a knight will actually do. I think that George is trying to teach her and us that there really is no true knight. But you really need to see that mythology first to have it deconstructed.
You do, and I think that the interesting thing is, I've seen, and Elio and I have talked on a number of occasions on the parallels between, in that sense, between Sansa and Brienne.
Yeah.
Because, it first of all, it is quite funny that when you're sort of talking about the true knight, I mean, Brienne, who cannot be a knight, is perhaps the truest knight in the whole of the series in that, because she really tries to live up to these ideals. And in many ways, she is a Sansa in that she has this very naive outlook, and she also believes in chivalry. Uh-huh. She believes in things being beautiful and righteous and just.
Also core to her identity, right?
Is very much core to her identity, and the way she attaches herself to Renly and sees him as an example of a just king, and he's kind, he's beautiful, he has, you know, treated her well with, you know, courtesy and all of that, and then of course it's chipped away from her. She holds on. And I mean, to some extent, Sansa tries to hold on to her identity as well. But this whole stripping away of things that are important to you and stripping away parts of your identity happens to so many characters.
I'm thinking, I was going to try to get to this a little bit later, but I might as well mention it now. I do think that there's this back and forth between how I feel about the Hound, because I feel like I've been trained, you know, just being a reader of literature and reader of fantasy literature in particular, I've been trained to think, okay, here's the Hound who looks like a villain, but what do I know about him so far? He tells the truth, and twice Sansa has stumbled in this story, and he has helped her from stumbling. He did the first time they met. She stumbles because she's afraid of ill and pain, and she like trips over her feet. And she initially thinks it's her father that has kind of caught her from falling, and she turns around and of course is the Hound, and she freaks out. Well, that something similar happens in this story too. She stumbles and the Hound catches her from falling. And I think that I'm supposed to believe, okay, well, this guy looks like a villain, but in reality, he may be a true knight. You know, he's not a knight in truth, but he may be a truer knight than his brother, for instance.
Yes.
And then the story ends, and I'm thinking, oh, well, he's threatening to murder a little girl. So he's kind of an asshole too.
Yeah.
but that's the brilliant that's the brilliance of this book, is that he is an asshole. We have a lot of indications that he's an asshole, but he's a lovable scoundrel, right?
Yeah.
Both of those things can be true, right?
Yeah, that they can. I mean, he's already killed Micah.
Yes.
And done so in a very, you know, he didn't run fast enough. Very sort of.
Cold. He makes a joke. Yeah, a joke about it.
Yeah, and he carries out various commands of Joffrey's, and he knows that Joffrey is a little shit.
Yes.
And he does these things anyway. He takes some sort of perverse pleasure in being his dog. I think because he obviously has a very strange outlook on himself, on his place in this society. He's so disillusioned about knights and spits on being called a sir, which is not strange given the view of knighthood that being, you know, Gregor Clegane's brother would give you. He knows that you can be a knight and a complete monster, so it's given him a very bleak outlook on things. It's very interesting. The first time that I read Game of Thrones, I reacted very negatively to the Hound. I would, because in part, if there's any character that I can identify with how I would react sort of in the story, it's Sansa, actually, in a sense that I grew up reading stories about King Arthur and the Round Table, and had this very idealistic view of chivalry and knighthood. So to have somebody say that, you know, knights are, you know, pile of crap, basically. I kind of, you know, I don't like this guy's attitude at all.
Well, he is a child murderer. I mean, there is that part.
Yeah.
It's hard to get away from that fact of the matter. Tell me this. I mean, certainly Gregor is a monster, but I think that Sandor knows that there's a little bit of that monster in him too. And I think he knows, for instance, that I don't know if he enjoys being Joffrey's dog, but I think that being Joffrey's dog allows him a certain power and a certain freedom to be a man of violence. Whereas if he was working for someone else, if he was working for Renly or something, then he wouldn't have nearly as much opportunity to sort of explore that part of himself.
True. I mean, I think he has been made. I mean, he's damaged, and he feels, I think, that I might as well live up to this personality that life has given. People are going to flinch when they look at me. Mm. So I'm going to give them a reason to flinch.
Right.
I'm going to be the monster that they think I am, right, by my looks. So in some sense, it is that self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah. Much like the way that Jaime kind of tries to take pride in being called the Kingslayer.
Yeah, he really kind of leans into that identity.
Whereas, right? I mean, he started out as a Sansa himself.
Huh. Yes.
He started out admiring these great knights, admiring Arthur Dayne, wanting to be the Sword of the Morning.
And praying to the warrior, right?
Yes. And then has that taken away from him, and has sort of the veil pulled from his eyes, seeing how, you know, Aerys is treating his wife, and the fact that the other Kingsguard will not intervene, and that he's just supposed to keep to his vow and stay out of it. And then when he then becomes the Kingslayer, he sort of tries to take pride in it, just like Sandor tries to take pride in being viewed the way he is. And there's a capacity for violence in these men, absolutely. In the society, there are very few men who don't have this capacity for violence brought out.
Well, and in certain contexts, it's rewarded, right? I mean, we saw something like that in the blood sport of the tournament. If you can focus that capacity for violence, you can do well. And as long as, you know, the state has kind of rubber stamped, you know, this is the kind of violence that is okay, then the person who does it best will be rewarded for that.
I mean, there's a very interesting contrast that I hadn't thought about before in what happens. The first bloody thing that Sansa notes in the chapter is the hedge knight that disgraces him by killing Beric Dondarrion's horse by mistake. And he is then he forfeits his victory. Whereas nothing like that happens to Gregor Clegane for actually killing his opponent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The horse is valued higher.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there are these rules
that this kind of rubber stamp the good kind of violence, but the bad kind of violence will bring you disgrace. And I think that the Hound is someone who, he knows that it's all bullshit. Like, he's going to call bullshit on the whole thing. And because everyone is telling themselves the same lies, and he knows that they're lies, he has no incentive to be anything other than Joffrey's dog. He knows what he is. And he feels like, I'm the only one that, I don't know if he feels this way, but this is what I project on him, that he's the only one that can tell the truth about how this is all just a big deception. But, you know, yes, he still joins the lists. He still competes. Yeah. You know, he still does what he's told. He can thrive in this, in the midst of all of this deceit.
Yes, but I think you're absolutely right that he very much feels like, I'm the only one here who's telling myself or anyone else the truth about what this means. Obviously, you have people who manage to very much live up to and balance the ideals in a reasonable way and live long lives being fairly honest with themselves. I'd say that, you know, Barristan manages pretty well, but even there you can argue he went from one king to the other. Should he have done that? So he has life choices that he's not entirely comfortable with either, but he seems to still mostly believe in the ideals. So there, it's not just the very young that manage to still believe in the ideals of chivalry. Sometimes they manage to hang on, but a lot of people probably grow very disillusioned over time and realize that it's a game that they play.
You mentioned I do want to talk about Sansa. You mentioned that you have a certain affinity for Sansa. I want to read this one part because it's very striking and very different from the HBO adaptation in this way. So here's a chapter from. Okay, I'll just read it. The jousting went all day and into the dusk, and the hooves of the great war horses pounding down the lists, until the field was a ragged wasteland of torn earth. A dozen times Jaina and Sansa cried out in unison as riders clashed together, lances exploding into splinters, while the commons screamed for their favorites. Jaina covered her eyes when a man fell, like a frightened little girl. But Sansa was made of sterner stuff. A great lady knew how to behave at tournaments. Even Septa Mordain noted her composure and nodded in approval. And that paragraph has a little parallel later on where she's noticing the death of the knight who was murdered, basically.
Yeah. Yes.
And she looks on with fascination. I don't get the sense that Sansa is. I think that Sansa and Arya may have more in common than they would care to admit. Sansa is maybe on the surface is this sort of prim and proper little lady, but she has greater aspirations. And on top of that, she's not squeamish. And I thought that was a very great portrayal of someone who has sort of this potential to be, you know, someone like, I don't want to say Cersei, but Lady Olenna or Catelyn or something like, someone like that, who's a very strong and noble woman in this world.
There is a wolf somewhere deeper in, and obviously, and I mean, Catelyn is a very strong character as well, and has... Yeah. taught her daughter to be what a lady has to be able to do. And of course, the interesting part about the second section there where the Hue of the Veil is killed,
yeah.
Is the way that it is described from Sansa's perspective. It's almost beautiful.
Mm-hmm. She had never seen a man die before. She ought to be crying too, she thought. But the tears would not come. Perhaps they had been used up. Perhaps she had used up all of her tears for Lady and Bran. It would be different if it had been Jory or Sir Roderick or Father, she told herself. So she's noticing. She's also self-aware. She's noticing, maybe I should be crying, but I just don't feel anything in that way for this nameless knight or this.
Yeah. And also this, that she focuses on the, there will be no songs sung for him.
Yeah.
That was sad.
That his part death, was, yes.
The fact that she's still in her story here.
Yeah, exactly.
But just the way that she describes the blood there, that his cloak was blue, the color of the sky on a clear summer's day, trimmed with a border of crescent moons. But as his blood seeped into it, the cloth darkened and the moons turned red one by one. Very ominous and sort of, and very poetic in a way that she sees these. So she observes it and still sees it as, I said, it's sort of part of this story and she should be sad, but the saddest part is that he's not going to have any songs sung for him.
Yeah, I mean, this is all this entire event is,
and then the blood is just covered up.
Yeah, right. You just shove a little dirt on the blood. Let's keep going.
Which is interesting because you've got that parallel much later there, since you brought up Arya in after her murders at Harrenhal. Where she thinks or say that the rain will wash away the blood on her
hands.
Oh,
interesting. Okay. I hadn't made that connection.
It's gone.
Yeah, right. So yeah, the blood is fleeting. This person's life was fleeting.
Mm.
If they can manage to live well enough to be sung about, that's basically the best that you could do, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the view.
Immortality.
Yeah.
That's the immortality you can hope for.
Yeah, right. Sure. More about Sansa here. Linda, do you think that Sansa cares at all about Jane Poole?
I don't think they have a very deep connection. She feels clearly that Jane is a little younger and more childish than her. So, at this point, certainly she forgets about her.
Absolutely.
When she leaves with Septa Mordain, and
I get the sense
I think they've
that,
grown yeah, apart.
Oh, okay. Say more about that. Grown apart.
Well, in the sense that I think when they were back in Winterfell, and Sansa perhaps didn't think so much about the court and everything before Robert showed up and before the marriage was arranged. Mm. They were more on the same level.
Right. Okay.
But now Sansa has a marriage being discussed and she's going to be a great lady. It's like those where, you know, you've got your friends at school when you're 12, 13 or whatever, and then one of them gets a boyfriend or some new interests, and you can grow apart very quickly there.
Mm-hmm. I was just noticing that when, like, Sansa always notes her presence, but doesn't care to tell us anything. She doesn't devote any of her thought world to what's going on with Jane. She observes everything else. She observes the intricacies of the coats of arms and the colors and the snapping banners and the shining armor. And Jane Poole is an afterthought, even so much so that when she's clearly deeply disturbed by this murder, she's taken away. And Sansa doesn't even know she's gone. She just completely forgot about Jane, and then kind of notices a little bit later that she's gone. We don't know what happens to her during the feast. And it makes me think about where Jane's character will end up, you know, in dance. Yeah. And I think, oh no, no one cares about Jane. Like, Sansa's supposed to be your best friend. Sansa doesn't even care about Jane.
No, she's kind of Sansa's shadow here.
Yes.
Just, and obviously the fact that she then ends up being the replacement Arya.
The Arya, the fake Arya.
Right. The fake Arya is, it's interesting that she doesn't really have personality and character of her own. She as a character is overlooked. She's turned into nothing, really. She's just a name. Yes. And that name is then replaced.
Right. I like the shadow imagery. So she's lived her life in the shadow of these Stark girls, and her whole identity is about, you know, kind of orbiting their force of gravity. And then when she's plucked away from all of that, her entire identity is now replaced by a false identity, Arya Stark. So she really never gets the chance to be anything other than, you know, a poor shadow of one of these Stark girls. She's tragic, and I'm.
She is. I mean, she's one of these victims of the circumstances, much like when we see Brienne traveling around in the Riverlands and seeing how the small folk suffer from the war and how they don't really care who's on the throne or whatever. It's just, whoever it is, there's going to be fighting, and it's going. We're going to bear the brunt of it. Mm-hmm. So Jane is another of these sort of hapless victims that doesn't get a chance to have their own. She has her own story, but it's not given any place because the other stories kind of crush it.
Yeah, I wonder if we will hear, I wonder if her story will become more prominent because, I mean, I guess the analog here is she's almost the female version of Jon Snow, who is always kind of, you know, living in the shadow of Robb and orbiting the force of gravity that is Winterfell, but always sort of taking a role of subservience and knows that, you know, knows what he has to do.
Yeah.
And you know, he knows his place in the family. Jane is very much, you know, she's not illegitimate in any sense, but
no.
She does have that one down position and then just completely treated terribly as fake Arya.
Yeah. I think that with the time that Martin has invested in her in A Dance with Dragons, it's not a story that he's just dropping from that point. I mean, that unfortunately has been one of the writing problems, I think. Not Jane specifically, but the fact that he really wants to do right by as many characters as possible. So he always says that he imagines what the story is for all of them. This guardsman who's nameless, you know, he has a backstory. So whenever he brings somebody to the forefront and starts talking about what has happened to them, he tends to want to go and give them a full arc. A full story arc.
Hmm.
Usually, full story arcs mean that you're dead by the end of them in Westeros.
Yeah.
And given that he has said that he needs to reduce the number of point of views and characters in general, there's a lot of people who are going to see their stories wrapped up in that way, I think. But yes, he likes to see a completeness, not just saying, oh yeah, they passed through here and we get a little snippet of their story. Very much in contrast to We were The Last Light of the Sun by Guy Gabriel Kay.
I'm not familiar.
No, he's in that book in particular, he gives little snippets of people that the main characters encounter. And then he switches over for just very briefly to give like maybe a couple of paragraphs about this person that the main characters sort of brushed up against. Right. So just to show that there are many stories going on. And I can't tell all of them, but these decisions by the main characters are going to have effects beyond the circle of characters that I'm featuring. So just to show the whole tapestry of stories. Whereas George tends to like to, anyone who gets featured significantly gets a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I want to ask you a question about Robert and Cersei. Clearly, the feast ends and Robert bursts. You know, he's drunk. He says, "Look, I'm the king, and if I want to fight in the melee, I'll fight in the melee." Basically, that's what he says. And I always read that like, okay, this is just sort of Cersei trying to talk sense into a man who's clearly past his prime. And then I think, but I know more about Cersei than I once did. Is it possible that Cersei is goading him, that she actually really wants him to fight, and so she tells him, no, you can't, you absolutely can't, knowing that he will insist that he can?
Yes, I think so. There's maybe a part of her that feels that I don't want my husband, you know, making a fool of himself just because it looks bad for me. On the other hand, I think she's so used to just feeling ashamed about him, because that's really all she feels.
Yeah, he's always a fool.
He's a fool. He's drunk. He's fat. He's, you know, there's not an ounce of pride left in her for her husband. So whether it's conscious, I mean, she's cunning. So it could very well be conscious goading here that, you know, yeah, have him go out there and maybe, you know, break his back or something. I'm not sure she thought that he would, you know, get killed or something, but, you know, break a few bones and we can stick him somewhere for a few months and I don't have to deal with him, and serves him right.
Yeah, or
she knows how he's gonna react.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible that she thinks it will be better for me if he's dead. I will be the power behind Joffrey. Yeah. And I don't have to deal with this fool.
No, absolutely. She certainly feels that she would run things much better than he would. And they are probably the two least capable people to running Westeros that you could find. Well, okay, no, Moon Boy might be a little bit worse, I suppose. But I wouldn't vote for either Robert or Cersei.
Let me mention a few notable introductions in this chapter. Now, if I was going to mention every new name we met...
Not one of those chapters where you...
Oh, you can't. I mean, it's just... There's probably 50 names of knights that we'll never meet again that are mentioned. Or maybe we will. Maybe they'll come back into the story at a later date. But just a few things here. Well, we see Thoros and Beric tilt against each other. So it's interesting knowing where they end up going. Thoros is described as one with a flapping red robes and shaven head. The seven knights of the Kingsguard, we see them all together for the first time.
But they're all kind of nameless other than Jaime. It's just him that
stands out. That's right. Moon Boy is I think he's a wonderful book only character. Is he a simpleton? I mean, he's too shrewd. He's too smart to be a simpleton. Loras is clearly a stunner. I mean, he's
the rock star.
He's a rock star. Yes, right. In Sansa's eyes, he's a rock star.
Oh yeah, she's a groupie. She's a groupie for Loras.
And it's not an introduction, but Peter makes his introduction to Sansa. And I thought it was interesting how he does it. Her eyes are so glued to Loras.
Yeah.
That here he is standing over her you know, measuring her, touching her hair.
Yeah.
And she's not prepared for that. I thought that was a very interesting foreshadowing of that relationship.
Yeah, she's in his shadow.
Yes, that's right. Book versus show differences. Boy, there's a lot. This is so different.
I mean, this is one that suffered very much from it being first season, in the sense that even though in the first season they make a lot of attempts to stay very close, the budget isn't there. It's much like when Robert goes on his hunt and goes walking in the woods with three guys. That's not a royal hunt.
No, of course not.
That's four guys getting lost in the woods for some reason.
I've never thought about that, but you're absolutely right.
This is so rustic. It's this little country tourney. It's quite drab as well. I think the one thing that I would, you know, fault as a choice is the lack of color, because it is so important to the pageantry. Mm. And we see this simplification, which is unfortunately runs through the whole show, that you only have the main house's banners pretty much.
Yeah.
And then everyone is a banner man of them, and they don't have their own banners. So they don't show off all this heraldry and all the color and all the cloaks and everything that should make it look so wonderful. Mm. That is all simplified, some for budgetary reasons and some for the whole let's not confuse viewers too much.
Well, also the aesthetic. I think in general, the show has dulled Martin's story. And I mean,
it's shades of gray very much through everything.
Yes. And I think that there's, you know, there just everything from costume design to how much magic are we actually going to bring into this story? How many characters can we actually have on, you know, have a story arc for? There was so much of a reduction that had to happen to make the show work. And boy, oh boy, did it work. I mean, they knew what they certainly knew how to make a successful show. There's no doubt about that. But one of the techniques I think throughout was sort of a dulling of George's aesthetic.
I don't know that that was necessary. I certainly think you could have kept this, the contrast we talked about, the contrast between the pageantry and the storybook side, and then the down-to-earth stuff, just to bring out the contrast rather than having everyone crawling about.
Well, you know who I was thinking of? Yeah, maybe so. You know who I was thinking of specifically is Dario Naharis.
Mm.
Okay, so how does he look in the book? Well, he's got dyed hair. He's got a trident beard. He's got a golden tooth that gleams. I mean, he looks, if you were going to show that guy on screen, you would never look at anything else. He's dressed like a clown. Now, of course, Danny thinks it's great, right? But I think that you dull that character a little bit, and now he's just a handsome hunk of sexuality.
Yeah, I do think that Dario, depending on the actor, could have worked. I think that the first Dario that they had could have carried that off.
Maybe so.
And then for some reason they went. I mean, at least that guy was making an effort to be flamboyant.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then when they recast him, it was like, nah. You're just going to be over there picking some flowers. Which was the most Dario-unlike thing.
I know. That's not what would attract Daenerys Stormborn.
No, the flowers wasn't really the thing.
Maybe some
severed heads.
Yeah, right. Now, just as far as the show differences, in the show, there's a number of major differences. But one of the major differences is that Peter Baelish does a lot of exposition for Sansa.
Yeah.
And it really sort of is a short... I mean, you have to kind of condense a lot of that story into sort of bite-sized bits. And so that happens. But in addition to that, Baelish outs Renly and Loras as lovers, which was shocking to me. I mean, certainly that's not in the book. I mean, there's some subtle hints in the book.
Yeah.
But to say that like out in public where everyone can hear, I was kind of amazed that they just chose to tell the story in that way.
Yes, that seemed to be one of these things where they didn't quite trust the audience just to pick up hints,
mm-hmm.
which is odd because one of the things that they argued about early on and said that we didn't want to put in the hints about John's parentage early on because people would figure it out, you know, the, mm-hmm. the power of internet, you know, crowdsourcing of discussion means that you can't really hide these sort of things.
Sure.
Just looking at how people picked apart things like Westworld and found little clues and so on. And it's true. If your storytelling depends on absolutely hiding things, you're going to have a problem with the way the internet works. So in that sense, they didn't want to put out hints. But then, yes, with Laura's and Renly, for some reason, they felt that they needed to put it right out there rather than just hint, which would have worked as well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because it changes, obviously, Sansa's perspective.
I think so. I think...
I mean, she has no clue until later, if even then, when she thinks that they are, you know, rescuing her by having her marry. She thinks it's Loras that she's going to marry.
Yeah.
And it turns out that they're proposing a plot to marry her to Willas. She doesn't realize why Loras is not marrying or why Loras wants to join the
King's
Guard.
Yeah, she has no clue. In the show, what does that do for us? It basically, it cuts short any kind of interesting reveal about Loras. Or, you know, Renly is a much more subtle character in that regard. It kind of sort of cuts short that. It also tells us that Baelish is the kind of person who will use information to either threaten or undermine you or something like that. So it does develop his character in that way.
Yes.
It was unnecessary, I thought.
And correctly, I just glanced actually at our review of the episode, so I don't have it entirely fresh. But he does Sandor's story as well, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that is even more shocking to me because, I mean, Sandor has never told anyone.
Right, so Baelish has this information. And then he tells Sansa, and then he says, now, of course, if you repeat this to anyone, the Hound will kill you. So he actually tells her, and then he parrots the death threat.
Yeah.
But it steals that bit of complexity from the Hound.
Why is he telling Sansa that?
Right. Yeah, he's scaring her. I mean, Baelish is always a little bit odd to me on screen. Like, there are many characters like Tywin and Tyrion who I think are enhanced by my experience with the HBO show. Baelish is not one of them. But...
No, I think they used him too much as a plot device.
Hmm. Okay.
Having him driving things forward by saying certain things and by acting in certain ways so that there wasn't a consistency to his motivations.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on that point. And
having a schemer sort of,
yeah,
they felt that it lends itself, we can have him undermine people here and say things and overplaying his hand a lot of the time.
I think so. And the fact that we don't get a POV chapter from Littlefinger means that the show adapters can be a little bit more flexible with how they treat that character.
Yes.
Right. I have one more two-part question for you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Of all the characters in all the stories, who would be the character that you most identify with, like deep down inside? You know that you and that character are very similar, as opposed to the character that your friends and family see when they think of you.
That's a tough one. I think that probably I'm a bit of a Sansa at heart. There are some things that aren't very like me, but the sort of that some of that naive innocence. And I've always said, because I mean, Sansa gets, you know, a lot of complaints from some groups of readers on her, the way she acts and the choices that she makes in the first book. Mm-hmm. And people like to think when they're put in the situation that they are going to be Arya and not Sansa. Uh-huh. It's very much like people who read Donaldson's Thomas Covenant books and say, oh God, I can't read a book with such a horrible character who's acting like that. And I was like, well, you know, if you get dumped in a fantasy world in his situation, I think his reactions are perfectly reasonable. Hmm. I can very much see how his disbelief, his constant refusal to accept the situation, I'm not annoyed by it. I understand where he's coming from, even though unfortunately not afflicted by leprosy. So, but yeah, I get him and I get Sansa. You know, I'd like to think that I would be brave and resourceful and all of those things. But no, I have a bit of a Sansa in me. Mm-hmm. People knowing my temper, on the other hand, might think I'm a bit more of an Arya.
Right. Okay. So when people see you, they see a little Arya, but deep down inside, you know you're more like Sansa.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Thank you so much, Linda.
Oh, my pleasure. I really love discussing these books, mm-hmm. and it's been something that Elio and I have been doing back and forth for many, many years now.
Over 20 years? Fun. Has this been over 20 years?
Yes, and it's still a daily part of our lives, and right? We're very, very grateful.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And as Steve and I cover Misa, this is the finale of season 3. This is the episode where Bran and Sam encounter each other. Jaime returns to King's Landing. Ygritte finds Jon and shoots him with 3 arrows. And then, of course, Dany becomes the silver-haired savior as the Yunkai slaves receive her as their mother. Here is Steve Osborne. Steve, is Joffrey less handsome when he's happy or when he's pouting?
Gosh, yeah. Happy Joffrey is a really, like, some people are bad criers, like Tobey Maguire, for example.
Sure.
You know, I mean, that's
Michael Jordan. Yeah.
Michael Jordan. Yeah. I mean, the Tobey Maguire, Uncle Ben death and Spider-Man is, that's when you start rooting for the costume. And yeah, man, Joffrey. Like, somehow his face looks upside down when he's happy.
I think this is the happiest we've seen Joffrey.
He's morphing into, like, Veruca Salt in Willy Wonka.
Yeah, he undergoes a transformation. Sort of like a reverse transformation. Remember when Empire Strikes Back, when Luke undergoes a transformation into, like, a groundhog or some sort
of... Oh, yeah, when he learns the truth about Darth Vader, yeah.
Yeah, his whole face, he turns into some other creature.
Yeah, it's not...
This is sort of the reverse. If you were to throw that in reverse, you'd get Joffrey being happy.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah,
that's the big takeaway from the season finale. Joffrey's face.
Well, I will say this. Jack Gleason, he's tremendous. He just nails that part. I just can't imagine anyone else being that character. But, you know, I have mixed feelings about Joffrey.
As a character?
He's going through a hard time. I mean, it's not easy being Joffrey.
Okay.
You know?
Sure.
I mean, imagine you're in Joffrey's
I've had
position.
A lot of stress at work, too, but I've never crossbowed somebody to death.
No.
Also, I don't have a crossbow.
You're not the progeny of Twincest. That's one thing.
I don't know. I've never done the 23andMe.
Yeah.
I make a lot of assumptions, man.
You'd be at, like, 12 and a half in me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, enough with the math humor, Steve. So, dismemberment count increase.
Right. Both... Rob, in between the episodes, Rob's had his head lopped.
He loses his head, and Grey Wind does too, his wolf.
That's true. Yeah,
he gets dismembered. That was the opening scene.
Yeah, that's pretty rough. So, you know, that's the dramatic impact of the Red Wedding coming into this week. Like, what's going to happen? Am I going to get a drink of cool water or am I going to have more of the same, right? So there was a part, like, it's like, we're just going to pick right up there. Huh? Okay. And so, like, if you had any moment where you're like, maybe, you know, especially if you're going, like, week to week on this, where you've had an opportunity to just sort of let it settle. And you get the gumption to go back, right? Because like you said, there's probably some people that were like, no, I'm not going with this anymore. And not yet. Now, if you've got any of the swing states are coming in to watch this, and this could have pushed them, man. They could have turned it off right there. Now, you as the audience member feel like a member of Rob's army, so to speak, right? Like,
yeah,
you're rubbing it in to me now.
And you have that mocking callback to the way that the end of the first season, the King of the North chants, right?
Right.
And in addition to that, I think it shows an interesting amount of restraint to leave the back end of that Red Wedding scene to the next episode.
Yeah.
To know exactly, like, okay, we're going to cut this right at the most dramatic part so that the end of episode 9 is really the emotional gut punch. And then you're right. When we jump into this episode, it's like just rubbing it in.
Yeah.
You know, you've been stewing on the gut punch. Now we're going to rub it right
just,
in.
Just going right into it. And I mean, it is a lot. Like seeing him get paraded around, did the gut punch continue, right? It was like you realized, oh, the person hadn't taken their fist out of my stomach yet.
And of course, that scene bleeds forward to Arya's encounter with the Frey men along the road.
But it's an interesting and really important moment, right? Because I think you've had the, like you said, the gut punch, you've had this mockery. There is a sense of like, man, there's got to be some, is there any justice that can be served, right? And so here's Arya and face to face. And there's a part of us, I imagine most audience members have this like, man, something's got to happen to these guys, right? Mm-hmm. But then it happens at the hands of Arya, and Arya has essentially her first murder. So then this sense of justice.
Well, her first, let's say first premeditated murder.
Premeditated murder, right? Yeah. And so we have this moment where it's like, oh, it actually is a continuation of the gut punch, in my opinion, because instead of it being this like somewhat redemptive moment or an ushering in of justice, you're like, well, she's not going to be the same ever again. That's right. That's all a part of all this tragedy. Her moment is just an extension of the tragedy. So you get that like, well, yeah, these guys deserve to die in sort of your fictional body count mind. But then the way that it happens just further complicates it.
Well, you kind of nailed it a little bit when you said she's going to become John Wick. She is a little John Wick-y in this sense. And it is supposed to sort of scratch that justice itch. Although I have to say, it always sort of brings out a certain sadness for me. You know, I kind of feel like I just don't like seeing it. I mean, I know that I'm supposed to, there's supposed to be part of me that really enjoys seeing the vengeance.
Yeah. See, I didn't enjoy it. In fact, that was the thing. I'm like, it was kind of an interesting lesson, right? Because you think you want vengeance, but then at what cost? And I guess that's sort of, you could almost sum that up with the whole Rob narrative and kind of all of the narratives that involve vengeance, right? It's like, yeah, you're singularly focused on this, but then every step you make towards bringing in justice on your terms yields a new, you know, treacherous result that you have to navigate. This isn't a video game where the credits roll. This is, all these actions have consequences. And Heather's point was, she's like, well, now it's fitting that she's with the Hound because she's becoming the Hound.
That's right. That's right. We already made the Terminator connection.
Yeah.
Where she's kind of explained to him, like, this guy's innocent. Don't just kill him. And he doesn't. He just knocks him out or whatever.
Right.
But at the same time, so you could say that the Hound's becoming a little bit more like her and she's becoming more like the Hound.
Right. Yeah. So their relationship becomes overlapped in many ways.
Okay. So there's a major book difference from this point on in the HBO adaptation. In the books, Arya is having wolf dreams just like Bran was. Mm. And just so happens when she's sleeping after the Red Wedding, she finds her mother's body like floating down the river. Mm-hmm. And the wolf pulls Catelyn's body out of the river, and she's discovered by the Brothers Without Banners. And as we know, Beric has been resurrected 6 or 7 times or whatever. So he's like animated by this weird fire magic, and he ends up passing that to Catelyn. And so Beric dies and Catelyn is revived.
Well, that seems like a pretty big thing that happens.
That's a pretty big thing that happens. They call her Lady Stoneheart from that point on. Lady Stoneheart never enters the story. Martin always wanted her to be part of the story. The, Weiss and Benioff always wanted to kind of, look, we need to keep the magic to a minimum.
You know how I feel about that.
Yeah, well, you probably sided with Weiss and Benioff, right?
Yeah, I guess it would depend on the role she plays and then the ramifications of her absence, right, in terms of the narrative.
Well, what happens is Lady Stoneheart, you know, when Beric says, every time I come back, I'm less of who I was or whatever. Mm-hmm. when Lady Stoneheart comes back, she's like this vengeance monster. Like, that's all that drives her. She just wants vengeance. She's like, you know, all of her sort of...
like Pet Sematary.
Yeah. She gets Pet Sematary'd. That's right. That's exactly right. And she comes back and she's totally... she wants vengeance against Jamie and all of that business. So that's a really major character that we lose from the book narratives.
From a dramatic perspective, not bringing her back gives you a little bit more gravity going forward. Having her back is like, now you gotta reconcile that she's back. And there's like, and then I think it leads maybe to your other point. It's like, well, how come more people don't get resurrected during this thing?
Right. And I think that it also unmoors Arya to an extent. I think that knowing that Arya's mother is still in the world and you're still hoping for something of a reunion.
That's a distraction, I think.
Yeah, maybe so. I think that if you completely erase all of Arya's family, which essentially that's happened. I mean, there's still Jon, who's like lost up north, and there's still Sansa, who's now a Lannister, I suppose. Everyone that might comfort Arya is gone, and basically it leaves her with the only parental figure she has now is the Hound.
Right.
That's a big difference.
Well, and it was interesting because I was reading about one of the commentaries, and I think it was from Martin himself, talking about the killing of Rob and how it was kind of important to make it real clear to readers and fans and all that. This story isn't the story of Starks, per se.
Yeah.
And I think it'd be real easy, and I think that's probably why people are upset about the Red Wedding, is because, you know, you're kind of holding on to that. Like, well, isn't the Stark situation what we are kind of tethered to? And then to untether that feel, I think that's the feeling I had. I just felt very fragmented now. I'm like, well, so where...
Right. So the Starks are a little bit of a device to bring you to all the different places in Westeros. So like Jon goes north of the Wall. So we learn about that through Jon's eyes. Sansa and Ned go to King's Landing. We learn about that through their eyes. You know, Arya's sort of all over the place. So we're learning about all these different characters. So they are an important device. And Winterfell is sort of the place we're invested in. But even Winterfell's burned down at this point.
Right.
And so the story I mean, you got to be pretty confident that like this story is going to carry itself without the initial device that delivered the story.
Yeah, right. There has to be more of an element of virtue and family values and honor to it in order for any of that to matter initially. So the absence of it is fascinating, too, because it's like at some points it feels like an indictment on those concepts. And we see that, right? We see the idea of family values with the Tyrion-Tywin exchange.
Yeah, that was great. It told us so much about their relationship, but it also told us about Tywin's motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Because Tywin's really sort of the puppeteer for a lot of these major events.
Right, which is fascinating, too, because of Tyrion, you know, like there's that... now fleeting moment where he was the Hand, and there was a sense of like, wow, this is really an opportunity for him to shine. But at the end of the day, you find out Tywin is just like, yeah, you were there as long as I needed you to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, you know.
Well, like I think you said last time, Tywin doesn't mind moving his own children around like chess pieces.
Yeah.
He has a great succinct idea of collectivism versus individualism, because he's basically saying, look, you don't matter. Your sister does not matter. What matters is the larger legacy of the family.
Right. Why didn't you drown me? Because you're a Lannister.
Yeah, you're a Lannister.
To a certain degree, he reveals one of the main rules of the Game of Thrones.
That's right.
Because we've seen it between Ned and then Rob. This is the problem. Right. I mean, this was Ned's problem. And then now Rob, you know, he went and was like, well, I don't want to marry this person for strategy's sake. I want to marry this person for love.
This scene with Tyrion and Sansa, it really does hammer home their age differences.
Yeah.
He's really sort of like the cool older uncle. And you're really seeing like, man, these are she's such a teenager and he's just such a, you know, such a nice old guy, but he's an old guy.
Yeah.
And they're walking along. They're trying to connect. Tyrion's looking over his shoulder to see sort of Shay, you know, Tyrion's just in the worst possible situation, but they end up sort of connecting with sort of a, I don't know, connecting on kind of like a youth worker, troubled youth level.
Yeah.
They're finally kind of like realizing, oh, you have it bad too. You know?
Yeah.
We both kind of suck.
Interesting alliance kind of situation. Born from, it's interesting because the hierarchy of age, the hierarchy of gender are kind of thrown out the window a little bit in this exchange. It's an equality of circumstance.
And then it completely just unravels because whatever sort of goodwill he's building with her is totally lost when she realizes that the Lannisters killed my brother and mother.
Yeah, and you're a Lannister. That part echoes, right? When Tywin is like, I spared you because you're a Lannister, saying, look, regardless of what you do and whatever I think of you, your name is your identity. And so when he steps in there, he doesn't get to be Tyrion, the guy that's like, man, I'm on your side. I try to get Bran a real cool saddle. If it were up to me, Ned, you know, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. It's like, you're a Lannister. And that's, you don't get to have it both ways, right? You don't get to have the juice that takes, you know, that gives you the opportunity to eat free elsewhere, but then not be able to also take the blame.
Ramsay has his own way, Steve.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to play with your food, by the way. It's just one of the rules.
Yeah. Ramsay, I'm going to need this subplot to move along here.
Well, okay, so Ram.
I'm getting torture fatigue, man.
Ramsay's great at sort of, I mean, he's acting. It's
like Bizarro Sean Astin.
He really is. I'm glad you made that connection. That's really great. He's evil Sean Astin. he needs a goatee, I suppose.
Heather's still keeping score. She's like, you know, after all that, she's like, yeah, still don't care. Still don't feel for him.
One could say, Steve, is that we've now seen the end of Theon and the beginning of Reek.
Yeah, I could see that.
So, you know, maybe we're done with that character, but now we have this new character who Theon is kind of his backstory, but he's got different motivations.
He went from Smeagol to Gollum.
That's right. There we go. And Theon really has to kind of get to that stage where he says, kill me.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's completely given up. And that's exactly, and this is, you get the sense, this is what Ramsay's waiting for. In order to break him down, he has to be like at a stage where he's willing to let everything go. And then I can remake him how I want him.
Right. Well, and the thing is what is Theon, like even if Theon were to have gotten out or rescued, to what end?
Just to wrap up on Theon, I think that there were a lot of these torture scenes and it felt like a lot, but I feel like doing less would have made his total deconstruction unbelievable.
That's fair. And that's my take on that was just like, this better become something because it's a lot and it's a lot of like, all right. I mean, I don't know, you know, yeah, Ramsay seems like a pretty terrible person and Theon's getting his. So the idea that there's something to come from this is helpful. So that's interesting. So now you have the John and Ygritte, I don't know, goodbye, official goodbye, as opposed to him just taking off. And we do get a sense, and now we get full closure on the idea that if there was any thought that maybe John was wavering, sounds like it was never the case.
Do you feel like Ygritte kept, do you think that she meant to maim him and not kill him? Or do you
I think she could have killed him.
You think she could have killed him and decides she just wants to hurt him?
Yeah.
It would have been like breaking all of his favorite records. If he had favorite records, that's what she would have done.
Well, and I think there's a sense of like each arrow brought with it maybe a certain degree of hope. And the hope went both directions. I hope this kills him. I hope he lives.
Right.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'll read again from Caroline Larrington's book, Winter is Coming, specifically what she has to say about named weapons in the medieval world and in Game of Thrones. So this is from page 47. In Beowulf, the swords which are particularly valued are the old ones. They carry with them the mana, the aura of those who have been killed by them in past battles. They are redolent of victories won. When an enemy is defeated, the victor takes his sword and makes his defeat part of the weapon's history. Side note here, we can kind of see a little bit of this behind the Iron Throne, which is composed of the swords of fallen enemies. Back to Caroline. Beowulf borrows the famous sword Hrunting for his battle against Grendel's mother. Although no metal can pierce her hide except for her own ancestral sword displayed on the wall of her den. For the first time in its history, the poet observes Hrunting fails. Beowulf's own royal sword, Naglin, proves unable to prevail against the dragon that is his nemesis, and it shatters on the monster's skull. Medieval swords often have names, signifying a relationship which is closer to that of human and animal than in human and inanimate object. Arya may have to drive her beloved direwolf Nymeria away, but she holds on to Needle as long as she can. And her recovery of it in killing Polyver signifies a major turning point in her fortunes. Ned's greatsword, Ice, marks his first and last moments in the story. We see him draw it from its wolfskin scabbard to execute Will for his desertion of the Night's Watch, and Ilyn Payne uses it to behead its owner at Joffrey's command. So mighty is Ice that Tywin has forged it into two new swords by a smith from Volantis. One of three smiths who still know how to work Valyrian steel. The first sword, characteristically named Widow's Wail by its new owner, is presented to Joffrey as a wedding gift. The second is given to Jaime, who in turn gives it to Brienne to take with her in her search for Sansa. Brienne names the blade Oathkeeper in honor of the oath she's sworn to Catelyn. And Longclaw, the Valyrian sword of House Mormont, given by Lord Jeor, commander of the Night's Watch, to his son Jorah, is recovered by him when Jorah flees Westeros. Longclaw is equipped with a new pommel, ornamented with the direwolf of House Stark, to replace the bear of the Mormonts, and presented to Jon Snow. This is a poignant moment for both giver and receiver. Jeor has abandoned hope of seeing his son again, for Jorah's dishonor, selling Poetress into slavery, cannot be easily purged. In giving the sword to Jon Snow, Jeor, in effect, signals that the young man should be his successor, just as Sam had foretold, and he becomes a kind of second father to him. Swords are charged with an emotional power which goes far beyond their function in war. So my thanks again to Caroline Larrington for her insight, and that's all for this week.